Blog Talk Radio.
We'd like to welcome you to Africa on the Move as your host, Brother Africa. Today we're going directly back home. We're going to deal with an issue and a problem that typifies the slogan that you often hear, out of sight, out of mind. I think this case really speaks to this particular slogan, out of sight, out of mind. And what we're talking about is the crisis in the Congo. What is the Congo? What is going on in the Congo? And how does the Congo relate to the well-being of our people and our survival? And to discuss the subject with us tonight, we have with our guest, Brother Paul Pumphrey. He's a international traveler. He's been an activist for years, political organizer. And he's going to be giving his views and perspective, particularly on this crisis inside the Congo. So right now, we'd like to welcome Brother Paul. Welcome to Africa on the Move, Brother Paul.
Thank you, Brother Africa. I find it a pleasure to be able to share some information with your audience.
Good. Now, Brother Paul, one of the things, if you could do for our listening audience, just give us a brief background of who you are and some of the experiences you have had as relates to dealing with movements and our people's struggles.
That may take up your whole show. I'm a person who basically came out of the background of the civil rights movement as a young person. I actually joined the civil rights movement when I was about 9 years old, and that carried me through to my early, late teenage years. I became a member of the Black Panther Party, and from there I became an organizer for United Farm Workers Union, in which I organized a couple of different offices in the state of Florida for United Farm Workers, and then left Florida about 75 and came back up in Maryland and became a co-founder of the Anti-Apartheid Movement USA and worked closely with the liberation movements out of the countries of South Africa, Namibia, and Zimbabwe. And then from there I did some community organizing and labor organizing. And in 2004 I became one of the co-founders of Friends of the Congo, and we were very concerned about what was happening in the Congo, and so myself and two other folks began to look at what we needed to do about it, and we agreed on setting up a nonprofit to really help inform the public, both inside the United States and other parts of the world, about what was happening in the Congo, because we felt it was a crisis that needed to be shared with other people. My experience had taught me when I worked with the struggle around apartheid that the U.S. corporations and the U.S. government was really enjoying the opportunity of maximizing their profits off of apartheid, with the public of the United States being kept uninformed about what was going on. But once we began to educate the public about apartheid, that the public began to have great concerns about U.S. foreign policy as well as U.S. corporate policy. And I strongly believe that if we did the same thing around the Congo, we could build a similar movement in putting pressure on the U.S. government and U.S. corporations and changing their policy. One thing is clear, that since 1996 to date, there's been over 6 million people who have lost their lives in the Congo, and it's because of resources. The Congo happens to be one of the richest countries in Africa. It's located right in the center of Africa. It's a country that has approximately $23 to $24 trillion worth of minerals in the ground. And mining companies who want to get those minerals out for the multitudes of multinational corporations who like to refine those minerals and use it in their industry recognize that it's kind of difficult to mine those resources if people are living on the ground above them. So it seems that there's been a policy pretty much complicit with these corporations, that the U.S. government has played a major role in, amongst other companies and governments, of using a war as a method of moving people off land so that those lands can be exploited for its minerals. And I say that because when pressure is put on U.S. policy, we see that the war dies down and it changes in the way they have carried out their war of destruction and murder. I'll give a good example. We started we meaning Friends of the Congo, started a campaign, a postcard campaign, encouraging people to send in postcards to Secretary Kerry, insisting that the Obama administration follow a law that President Obama himself was the author of when he was a senator. And the law was really focused on saying that the U.S. government, through the State Department, should not give any assistance to any government that has been actively participating in the war, that can be shown to be actively participating in the war in the Congo, or in profiting off of the resources that are being taken out of the Congo. And two countries in particular, and that's the neighboring country of Uganda and Rwanda, have consistently violated this part of the law. And so if the United States was following its own law, which President Obama himself was the author of, and both Secretary Kerry and Secretary Clinton, when they were senators, co-signed this law, so they're very familiar with the law as well, that it would mean that the U.S. government would cease giving assistance to Uganda and Rwanda as long as they were participating in the war. And as postcards began to grow in numbers and going into the State Department, and people became more aware of the law itself and of the fact that the United States is still giving assistance to those two particular countries, we recently found that all of a sudden, the organization called M23, which was leading an armed campaign against the people of the Congo, put down their arms and decided to call for a ceasefire inside the Congo. And we strongly believe it had a lot to do with the increased awareness of the role that Rwanda and Uganda was playing in that war, and the potential that it would be a momentum built where we've been a big demand that the U.S. government cut off their assistance to both of those governments. And rather than have that happen, all of a sudden, armies that were taking over major cities in the eastern part of the Congo put down their arms and called for a ceasefire. So that's just one example of, we feel, that helps show that if people are made aware of what is going on in the Congo and the atrocities going on there, and made aware of who's behind it, that we can put pressure on U.S. foreign policy that can bring some relief to the people living in the Congo who have been suffering because of this war.
Paul, for those of us who know very little of the history of the Congo, can you just give us a little brief background in terms of historical development and how it got into the predicament of, you said it's up to 1996, there has been a projected cost of over 6 million lives been lost. Can you just give us a little brief history here of the history of the Congo? Who were some of the forces? How it shaped the Congo today? Who were some of the major players from the past as well as today? Particularly talk about this issue of the international community and the systematically looting that has been going on in the Congo for centuries. So can you speak to our people on that?
Mm-hmm. Well, in Europe, there was a conference in Europe to discuss how pretty much to divide up Africa, because the European government felt that Africa belonged to them. And so they were all jockeying for position as to who would take control of different parts of Africa. And this conference in Berlin took place around 1884 and 1885. And the United States played a role because the United States actually, with the help of a surveyor, a U.S. surveyor by the name of Stanley, pushed that in the Berlin Conference that the control over the land that was known as the Congo at that time, the Congo Kingdom, be given to King Leopold II, who happened to be the king of Belgium at the time. Now, we need to clearly understand what this means. The land area of the Congo is about the size of all of Western Europe. And Belgium, which is one of the smallest countries in Western Europe, their king was given the rights, the total rights of this one country, this one area of land, in which he looked at that property basically and treated that, all that land as if it was his personal piece of property, including all the people living there at the time. Now, this is after even, of course, this is about 20-some years after slavery had been brought to an end, supposedly here in the United States, that this agreement was made. And so from 1885 all the way up until 1908, which was about 23 years, King Leopold II pretty much was the broker for whatever happened in the Congo. The other agreement was that any of the colonial powers that had staked out different areas of Africa had the right to use the Congolese River to transport any supplies, especially from the eastern part of Africa to the Atlantic Ocean, because the Congo River, which starts right at the eastern part of the Congo, travels all the way to the Atlantic Ocean, and that they would be able to haul the cargo through the Congo without having any tariffs put on them. This allowed for many of the European countries to explore the wealth of the different natural resources in countries such as Tanzania, such as now we know as Kenya, and many other countries, Mozambique and other countries that were on the eastern part of Africa. Now, from 1908 to 1960, what had happened was King Leopold, in his effort of trying to exploit the Congo, in particular for ivory and for rubber. And who was going to be the recipients of most of that rubber? It was the United States, because of the automobile industry's need for rubber tires. So there was always a connection with U.S. business interests and whatever happened in the Congo. And the United States operated from the very get-go as a behind-the-scenes partner with whoever was running the show inside the Congo. And this is what they did with the King Leopold II of Belgium. But he was so vicious in his ruling of the Congo, there was estimated about 13 million people lost their lives in those 23 years. And so because of some missionaries and other folks, one of them happened to be an African-American missionary who began to document the viciousness of what was happening in the Congo to the Congolese people by those people in which were working on behalf of King Leopold. The outcry came so strongly about the viciousness of how he ran the show there, even though he never, not one time in those 23 years, ever stepped foot in the Congo himself. The Europeans got together and decided to shift the control of this country that was bigger than Western Europe itself from the King of Belgium to the government of Belgium in the year of 1908. And from 1908 up to 1960, the official as far as Europeans were concerned, controller of the Congo was the Belgian government. And then in 1960, the Belgian government was given its independence. The Congo was given its independence, in which the Belgian government looked at it as something that they were kind of forced into doing by the people of the Congo, but they really did not want to relinquish power, so they wanted to really keep their troops inside of the Congo and keep things going the way they were. But the people of the Congo elected a gentleman by the name of Patrice Lumumba, who was clearly a patriot and was properly supported throughout the country. The Western powers felt that Patrice Lumumba, who actually made a number of appeals to the United States in looking at creating a partnership with the United States and feeling that the United States could play a role in helping the Congo move forward. But President Eisenhower, who was president in 1960, made a decision that Patrice Lumumba had to go. And so on January 17, 1961, he was assassinated. And he was assassinated with a great deal of help from the Western powers, including that of the United States and the Belgians, along with some of the Congolese elite. And when he was killed, from about 1961 to 1965, the Belgians, for the most part, ran the Congo. At 65, there was a decision made to put a gentleman by the name of Mobutu, who was basically the head of the military, the Congolese military, in charge, and then he declared himself as the owner or the ruler of the Congo, and that everything in the Congo belonged to him. And the United States, who often claims that it was a strong believer in democracy, immediately recognized him in that position and began to give Mobutu assistance along with the other European countries. And in return, he then gave the U.S. corporations, European corporations, access to a lot of the different raw materials that had been discovered inside the Congo. Now, when we talk about the raw materials, outside of rubber and ivory, the Congo was quickly known to have a great deal of gold, a great deal of diamonds, a great deal of copper, of cobalt, and cobalt is a mineral used to strengthen steel, to make steel armored. So like tanks, you could not have tank armor without cobalt mixed in with the steel. And virtually there were only two places in the world that had cobalt of large quantity. One was Russia and the other one was the Congo. When we look at World War II, the uranium that was used for the bombing of Japan originated from the Congo uranium mines. They found that the uranium out of the Congo was much, much more pure. It made it easier for them to make it into nuclear material than the uranium found in the United States in the West. And so you saw that there was immediately, a connection between U.S. corporation and U.S. government in the oppression and exploitation of the people of the Congo. Now, as we moved on, we move around what was happening around 1996, where most people are aware of, which is described over the media as the genocide war in Rwanda. Well, Rwanda was also a Belgian former colony, and it was clear that in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, there was a new mineral that came on the scene that showed a great deal of promise for sophisticated electronics and was known as coltan. And this mineral was found to be in very large quantities. They found some quantities of it in Australia, but they found huge quantities of this happens to be in the eastern part of the Congo. And lo and behold, the United States came to a conclusion, it appears, that whoever controlled the Kotan controlled the electronic industry as it was moving into its new phase of more miniaturized electronic products. In fact, you cannot find miniaturized electronic products today anywhere that does not have Kotan in it. If most people may remember when cell phones first became available, they were very large casings for the cell phone because they actually had to have an electric motor to run the fan to keep the electronic components cool. But the properties of Kotan actually cuts down on the heat generated through electronic products as well as it holds electric for a long time. And so it became ideal to use Kotan in miniaturizing electronic components. And so history has shown that the United States then... I'm sorry?
No, I didn't mean to interject, but I did want to say it seems again the scramble for Africa again is back on.
No question about
just
that.
Just the recent history,
and it was
which
key.
Was just stated.
Yes, it was key for the United States, I believe, that because they could not get enough partners inside the Congo to carry out the kind of atrocities that they felt they needed to control the land with the coltan and the diamonds and the coal and the copper and the cobalt and what have you, and the diamonds, that they needed a third party. And they saw in that third party the country of Uganda, and they saw potential of using two other countries, that of Rwanda and Burundi, which all three join borders along the eastern part of the Congo. But the government of Rwanda at the time, and this was in 1965, was controlled by a government that was pretty much more aligned with some European partners like that of France and Belgium than it was with the United States. And so the United States seemed to appear to take advantage of getting rid of that government through the war that took place in Rwanda, which everybody seems to know it as the Rwandan genocide. But you find, for example, President Clinton claiming to the public that he really didn't know anything about the genocide happening in Rwanda while it was happening in Rwanda. Yet, on the other hand, most people know that the national security advisors to any president of the United States reports whatever is going on that they consider as important to the president every day. And it's kind of hard to believe that they did not advise President Clinton after the first 100 people were killed in Rwanda, let alone 800,000 people being killed in Rwanda during that war, as to what was happening in that war and what were the casualties in the war, etc. But yet President Clinton came out on the press conference and said he didn't really realize what was happening in that war until it was coming near to the end of the war itself. But it allowed for a new government to take place, and that government became very, very closely aligned with U.S. foreign policy in Africa. And within a year and a half after that new government came into power, now we need to understand this. During the Rwandan War, close to 800,000 people lost their lives. Another 2.5 million people went into exile. And after this war has taken place, a newly established government is able to organize an army and take on a country that borders it. And that country happens to be larger than Rwanda by about 90 times. In other words, you could take the size of Rwanda and put it inside of the Congo at least 90 times and have some room left over. How does a country so small is able to take on a country so big and so rich? and be able to march from its
border. What I want to do right now,
yes.
What I want to do right now, Paul, I want to stop you. Time is limited. I just want to alert our listening audience that we will be going over today on this program. So if you want to hear the entirety of this program, please go to our archive at www.blogtalkradio/AfricaOnTheMove. But we have a caller here that's been waiting for a while. Let me get our caller in and let him state his views or comment on this topic tonight, the crisis in Congo. Caller number 6029, welcome to Africa and Move. Your question or comments to our subject tonight, dealing with the crisis in the Congo. Yes, caller, 6029. Go ahead.
Peace to you, Brother Paul, and peace to Brother Africa. You know, the more things change, the more they remain the same. You know, historically, this the neocolonial expeditions, you know, have been a common theme in terms of, you know, the pursuit of Africa resources. Even in situations where Africa, sells its commodities on the world market, Africa has been consistently, you know, shortchanged in terms of the value, you know, Western nations place on the resources, very valuable resources that it gets from Africa. And so it seems to me that nothing's going to change. In fact, it seems to me that this rush for Africa resources is really going to intensify, and I think that's precisely what's happening, and Congo is a perfect example. But one of the things I want to ask you, your guest in terms of, and maybe he asked him to extrapolate a bit, but recently, George Soros, the billionaire hedge fund operator, recently he put up $1.3 billion of hedge funds, betting that the U.S. stock market will in fact collapse. And so that is sort of indicative in terms of just how precarious the system is. And because the system is global economic system is so precarious, then it has major implications not just for Africa, but for African people throughout the world. And I just want to ask your guest, in lieu of this, what are some realistic, viable strategies in terms of really confronting, you know, this reality? Because the thing is that no matter how much we want to believe that Barack Obama, in fact, is progressive, or that somehow Barack Obama is concerned about the issues around Africa, clearly from a systemic point of view, he can't be, and he's not. And so, therefore, what can we realistically do in terms of incorporating some real strategy in terms of bringing about real change on the continent, and keeping in mind that the whole evil of class and of tribalism and cultural differences also plays an issue in terms of the continent. So what can we realistically do in terms of impacting on, you know, U.S. foreign policy as it impacts on Africa?
I think the first thing is to try to educate oneself on what's going on there. And I say, and when it comes to the Congo, I'd encourage people to go to our website, and it's www.friendsofthecongo.org. That's friendsofthecongo.org. Another thing I would encourage them to go to another website, and that is a documentary we put together, and it's called www.congojustice.org. That's congojustice.org. Those are two things to get you some information about what's going on there so you have a good idea and a picture of what's going on in the Congo and around the Congo today. But secondly, I think that a major mistake we make in this country, in the African-American community, is that we don't pay attention to some of the ways of how Africa is robbed the most. And one of the biggest ways Africa is robbed the most is that we pay attention to the price of raw material coming out of Africa, but we never compare it to the price of the finished product that those raw materials create. For example, gold is sold usually at 1/7 the price of refined gold. So whoever's refining the gold is really the one making all the money. So they could buy gold out of parts of Africa, Congo, Ghana, or wherever, at the price they buy in the gold, it's only 1/7 of the price that they're going to end up with. And the international market, as it's described, basically I call the European market, sets the price of the raw material and they set the price of the finished product. And as long as that happens, you're going to find that Africa will be robbed of its wealth because they never will get a true, honest value of anything that's coming out of the ground of Africa as long as you got the scheme set up the way it is in the so-called international business market. Okay? I mean, that will be anywhere from cocoa to diamonds to gold to coltan to cobalt, you name it. And so it would behold people of the African community here in the United States who would want to have a situation that would allow for the people to be able to assist our brothers and sisters in Africa to look at ways of how we can begin to refine the gold or refine cut the diamonds or refine the copper or refine the cocoa even, you know, and then take that wealth and use that wealth to benefit education, health care, and development, not just in Africa, but even in our own communities here. We have that ability to do that, and often we're not taking advantage of that capabilities of doing that. These corporations can refuse, and they do refuse, to sell this technology to African people in Africa. But as long as a person has a citizenship here in the United States, as long as we have the money, they cannot refuse to sell it to us without us being able to take them to court for discrimination. And so if we create those kind of partnerships, we could then take some of that wealth that gets generated from raw materials in Africa and help rebuild the communities both there as well as here. Secondly, we can organize and put pressure on our government to stop doing the kind of policies that is destroying Africa today. I hope those 2 points may can answer the question you just asked.
To my caller and to you, Paul, let me raise an issue with both of y'all, and let me get a response. One of the illusions of our so-called liberation period during the 60s, where we received our political independence, and that was really the next step is always your economic independence, which clearly we see we have not gotten there yet. But there has been certain policies that these governments have accepted or have been imposed upon them that will allow African countries and any continental country very hard to get out of their colonization if 85% of all their national reserves of their money or their currency must be in the bank that is controlled by the former colonizer. For example, I was just researching this question of France as relates to their former colonies. And I came across an article, some information where they say that 14 African countries that are forced by France to pay colonial tax for the benefit of slavery and colonization. Yeah, 14 African countries, and the Congo is one of those, where 85% of their reserves must be in a French bank. How do we deal with those kind of policies? How do we overcome that? What needs to be done as relates to even structure speaking, how the international system, capital system is set up?
I'll go a step even further. We're talking about a different stage of capitalism development. Now we're talking about global capitalism, which is a totally different ballgame from monopoly finance capitalism. So global capitalism is more pernicious, even more intransigent, even more desperate in terms of its appeal, in terms of just trying to survive. And so therefore, all those policies which tends to empower a nation can never be endorsed by the powers that be of the Western nations. On the contrary, what you have is a global economic system make damn sure that the exploitation of the past is relatively moot compared to exploitation practice now. So now African governments have no power over the economy. They have no power over wages. They have no power over term rights for people to have jobs. They have zero power. And this is the fundamental problem that we face in terms of what do we do in terms of overcoming that. As much as I would like to believe that we could appeal to the U.S. government, I understand that global capitalism doesn't have a conscience. And so, therefore, for those of us who advocate, morality, then it's likely to fall on deaf ears because these politicians, the system really doesn't understand what morality means. For the system, everything's expedient. It's about what you can, the most you can get at the cheapest price. I think the solution for Africa has to be a central bank. I think Gaddafi was essentially correct in terms of central bank. So that question in terms of setting commodity prices, the central bank of Africa being positioned to set commodity prices not only for a particular country but all of Africa. Now the problem is whether or not corrupt African leaders would in fact get in bed with the notion of a centralized bank in Africa. But keep in mind, even when it comes to the Organization of African Unity, there were corrupt African leaders who resented this notion in terms of unity, so that power was taken out. So now it's called an African organization because they resented this notion that we got to have unity, you see. So therefore, these narrow interests that exist on the continent, undermines Africa's ability to develop. So when I ask the question, realistically, what do we do in terms of addressing this, I think one of the things we have to do, I think, is incumbent upon those in the Western world who have access to the information to actually to build institutions on the continent in terms of working with conscious brothers and sisters on the continent to push forward this idea. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not naive. I do understand that to do this is going to be very, very difficult because those Western intelligence institutions in those countries, the moment you start doing that, you become a target. So it's not going to be easy. So I'm only giving that an impression that it's going to be easy. But I think it's very, very necessary in terms of doing. So we have to be very, 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 very careful in terms of how we go about doing it on the continent in terms of trying to bring about that change. But I think it is possible. So that is my response in terms of the real dilemma that we face in terms of, African people, worldwide, and particularly on the continent. This is the problem. And so I think we have to think beyond the box in terms of resolving this. I don't think we can call upon, Western governments to be an ally in our fight to bring justice or to bring fairness or to bring honesty and integrity to this whole process. Particularly with this process we call globalism, because it doesn't have a conscience. So I think we have to be first and foremost understand that is a concrete reality, and we have to operate on the premise that what you're dealing with is a system which is diametrically opposed to the self-interest of African people, not only the continent, but throughout the world.
One thing is clear.
Hey, Paul, your response?
Yes, one thing is clear, and that is that the West has shown it's very difficult for them to fight on two fronts. And that is, for example, if you mobilize the people in the United States to be opposed to the policy that is being promoted and pushed by the United States, it's very, very difficult, especially if the people in the countries that these policies are impacting are also mobilizing and fighting back at the same time. So when I was referring to addressing, mobilizing people in this country and educating people in this country, that is to, of course, create a partnership with our brothers and sisters in the continent. But we must have a challenge to U.S. policy here in the United States. And we can have some influence, I think, looking at what happened around apartheid was a good example in two ways. One, there was a positive example about the fact that we could put enough pressure, both politically and economically, to push the United States government that it really didn't want to change, but pushed them into changing their policy. The shortcomings of that was that people were more focused on going after the policy being changed without really doing the homework and understanding how that policy change could still undermine the future of the African people of South Africa. And so they got rid of the word of apartheid, but they kept the same exploited system that was set up in South Africa without the name of apartheid. And so many of the African people in South Africa today are as poor or even poorer than they were under apartheid.
even after the name of apartheid was taken out of the official policies of the state of South Africa. And many of us went back to our homes and kind of forgot about the struggle of giving solidarity support to the many African people that are still suffering in South Africa today. Instead, we basically said, okay, there's now a black government, now there's a black government, the problems have been resolved, so we don't need to put that on our front burner anymore, and we went on our merry way and got involved with something else. I dare say that we must look at not only the political aspect of what's happening in Africa, but we must look at the economic aspect of what's happening in Africa. And this is why I stress the point that you could change a government tomorrow in Africa, but if they don't have the ability to take advantage of their resources, whether it's their labor resources or their mineral resources or their agriculture resources to their fullest, they can still economically be put at a major disadvantage. And that's the role the people here can play a role in helping our brothers and sisters there. I see a role where historical black universities could play a major role. And working with many of the higher learning institutions in Africa today. But I agree with the point that the leadership in Africa today was often put in power with a tremendous amount of help from the governments of Western Europe as well as that of the United States and Canada. And so we clearly need to understand what is happening on the ground and build solidarity support with the progressive forces in Africa to have them have control of their own country and stop allowing these puppets being put in power. It's happened time and time again. And back to the point that my brother brought up earlier about France, one of the leaders of the progressive movements in West Africa from a former French colony shared with me that if you did an analysis of France, about 70 cents out of every euro dollar in France can be directly traced back to Africa. So if France was not able to super exploit Africa the way it has all these hundreds of years, France would be defined as a third world country today. And you could say that similar thing for Great Britain, Belgium, Germany, Italy, and the United States.
Okay, Paul, on that note, I'm going to have to stop you and let you know we've got less than 3 minutes in our closing summary. Can you just tell people again how you think quickly we can overcome this blockade of information as it relates to this crisis in the Congo? And how can people find out more information about the Friends of the Congo?
Okay, as I suggested earlier, they could go to our website, which is Friends of the Congo. .org, or you could email us at info@friendsofthecongo.org. Those are two ways of getting in touch with us, and we'd be more than happy to get back with you with information. We're also, for people who want to know more about what's happening in the Congo and a little bit of the history of the Congo, we encourage you to go to the website of Congo Justice. That's www.congojustice.org. And there is a video documentary we put together that's both in English as well as French.
Okay, on that note, we'd like to thank our listening audience for allowing us to come to their homes this evening and to have this critical discussion on the crisis in the Congo. There are so many things that is going on. We would like to do maybe a follow-up, so we'd like for you to stay tuned. And Paul, we'd like to maybe invite you and others back at a later date where we can continue the discussion, because there are so many things we could not discover in this short period of time. But we would like to thank you. We would like to thank you for what you have shared with our audience today, and we'd like to thank our participants and our listening audience for participating in today's show. Remember, Africa on the Move is a bi-weekly program, which is aired on Sunday evenings at 6 p.m. every other week. You can always feel free to call in at 323-679-0841. We understand that without information, people cannot think, and what organization they can represent clearly, so we like to always encourage our people and all freedom just people to join some organization in order to make humanity better. Until next time, let's continue to strive to go forward ever and backwards never. And remember, Africa is on the move. We thank you.
Thank you.